was a very exciting challenge or charge to me to be on this panel and to be able to think about a state adult immunization program given unlimited resources. I think as other speakers here today, I have to tell you that these are my personal opinions about what a state immunization adult program could look like, and it's not an official position of the Department of Public Health. I'm going to start with the current status of immunizations, adult immunizations in Massachusetts, and then I'll talk to you about what our future program could look like were we given unrestricted resources on, and I'm also going to, you know, review what my assumptions are for that, like Ann did. I'm going to start with our childhood immunization rates because we have been very successful in our childhood immunization rates. I'm going to show you our adult rates in a minute, which aren't where we have not been so successful. But also, I want to try to, at least in Massachusetts, look to our successes in childhood immunizations and the lessons learned from those to serve as the blueprint for how we can improve adult immunization rates. And that principle has actually been proposed by Dr. Mutri and then two of my, you know, heroes, Dr. Himmann and Dr. Ornstein, in several articles and editorials that they've written. And so I'm going to sort of try to apply those principles to what our program could look like. As you can see, our adult rates for influenza are, you know, a little bit above the national average, but we are not doing half as well in adult immunizations as we have been doing in childhood immunizations. This gives you a little picture of the adult immunizations that we do provide in our state. I'm going to show you our budget in a minute, but we provide about 800,000 to 900,000 doses of adult vaccines out of the approximately 4 million vaccines that we distribute in Massachusetts. We are a universal childhood program, and we're kind of a selective adult vaccine distribution program, and we right now only have staffing for about 4 FTEs. This shows you our budget. And as you can see, we don't use any of our federal funds for the purchase of adult vaccines. All of that goes to helping to maintain us as a universal select state. Right now, we're select only for HPV vaccine. But we use about $7 to $8 million every year, approximately, for adult vaccines, compared to our budget this year of about $109 million projected for childhood vaccines. And on those vaccines are really mostly restricted to public sites. And in Massachusetts, we have no county health departments, so most of that goes to community health centers with a few boards of health that offer vaccinations for adults, particularly influenza. We do have an adult immunization coalition, which just in like our childhood program is kind of very key to us because we don't have any public clinic system, and vaccination is mostly takes place in the private sector. And it's a very active coalition with 53 member organizations, but right now we only have funding to support one FTE and a few other activities that they help us out with. So now I'm going to get to the interesting part and look at assumptions. Like the other speakers, you know, I'm going to assume that there's a vaccine for adults program for everybody 19 years of age and older. It's going to cover all of the recommended vaccines given in all different locations. There's no restrictions on people only being able to get vaccines in certain sites. And regardless of insurance or residency status, and the timeline for funding after recommendations is very short. But as you know, we're a universal childhood state, but we still need to have first dollar coverage for childhood immunizations in our state, and I think we're going to always need to have some public-private payer partnership there. And so as a safety net, every state would have first dollar coverage for vaccine costs and administration costs, regardless of the place of vaccination. And as you know, that's a big challenge for children now. I'm going to be seeing that as a bigger challenge for adolescents and adults when private insurance doesn't pay for them to get vaccinated outside their medical home. And that reimbursement really needs to be clear and transparent. I think that really we've created almost an impossible situation for primary care providers. And that there's sufficient federal funding dedicated to registries, and I know, you know, Ann and LJ have talked about that, and that these registries will have the functionality for data exchange and interaction with electronic medical record systems, but also are going to really play a really important role in adult immunizations to be a platform for communication within states, within the state, you know, at all these different sites, as well as between states. So now comes to the fun part of the talk. So true, you know, we always talk about that, you know, we promote vaccinations across the lifespan, but now we can actually do that, and it will be a very happy time in my public health career. And again, just to build on this, you know, principle of looking at our successes and translating that into the adult arena, we want to really build on the successful strategies that we've identified in childhood immunizations and in Massachusetts in adult immunizations in our hospital standing orders project. And that is identifying partners is key, beginning with demonstration projects. That's what we did when we started out with our immunization action plans, and it really helped us, I think, figure out what worked in Massachusetts. And next time we would really be using demonstration projects both within the medical setting and outside the medical setting. And then really, you know, identifying champions. I think you've heard that over and over again in our careers here and in terms of people identifying what works for childhood immunizations and for standing orders. And I think it's really going to be true for adult immunizations, particularly true for adult immunizations, because the adult provider community, at least in my state, hasn't really embraced immunizations as an integral part of primary care. If for our state, you know, I'm assuming that our funding, our operational funds would double, and that we would have at least 13 FTEs that could work on adult immunizations. And our coalition, I think, would serve as our platform for all of our expansion, just like it has for our childhood immunizations. Our childhood coalition and our partnership in our situation, particularly with our Massachusetts chapter of the AAP and the AAFP, would sort of translate into the adult arena, and we would be able to fully staff our adult coalition. We'd have a number of subcommittees for outreach to non-English speaking and newcomer communities, which in Massachusetts is about 1 million folks and a really important component in the adult population. And we'd have subcommittees for the public and private sector. The objectives of the coalition would be to promote, you know, immunization in traditional and non-traditional settings, with traditional and non-traditional vaccinators being used. And pharmacists are allowed to give immunizations in Massachusetts, but only influenza, and we would have to expand that. And that we would have a standard of care sort of motto adopted by both primary and specialty care providers to say that they would assess vaccination status and offer it every visit. And that's been adopted in the childhood community, but really not in the adult community, and I'd like to sort of try to make that the motto of our state, and that we would enroll uninsured adults in health plans, and I'm going to talk to you about that in a minute. It's an effort that we have going on in Massachusetts, and there would be this huge registry rollout to the adult sector. So the first part about expanding access is that we would have massive enrollment of uninsured adults in health plans to increase the number with a medical home, and I've given you the website here of our Health Commonwealth Connector plan. But Massachusetts has embarked on healthcare reform for adults, and all adults are going to be required to have health insurance at the end of sort of a 3-year period. We're in the first year of that, and we have enrolled 300,000 out of the estimated 650,000 or so uninsured adults in Massachusetts. The effort was far more successful in the first year than ever imagined. And it has two components. It has a Commonwealth Connector plan for lower income adults, where they are either totally subsidized or partially subsidized, and then Commonwealth Choice plans, which really kind of offers a very competitive marketplace price for purchasing individual health insurance for individual adults that is comparative to what can be sort of bargained for by large businesses and large organizations. So it's been a very successful endeavor. The next phase would be massive enrollment of all these different adult providers that we are going to need to get into enrolled in our program, with a special target for OBGYN. And this is like the picture of us calling people, trying to get them to enroll in our program and go out and visit them. And this would truly be a daunting undertaking for us, because I know that we probably need to enroll about 2,000 to 3,000 more adult provider sites. We only have about 1,500 of what the projected target is enrolled in our program. And that doesn't even count all the non-medical sites. So this would be a huge issue, but we would be excited to do that. And we want to really encourage primary care providers and specialty care providers to vaccinate and not refer. And I know that that's been discussed a lot at the national level. And I think we are going to have to acknowledge some folks, at least initially, are just going to refuse to vaccinate. But we really hope that with this sort of massive influx of funding and operational funds, that we can convince those folks to vaccinate, just like we convinced a lot of the pediatric community to do that. And then to continue with expanding access, we would expand our standing orders project, and we would particularly want to concentrate on the vaccination of women antepartum and postpartum and include other family members, that so-called cocoon strategy that people have talked about in a number of plenaries and workshops here at this conference. And that would be sort of a core of our access program. And then we would continue with pharmacists, community vaccinators, and our other initiatives. I'm not going to talk too much here about education because other folks have touched on that. I did want to put a plug in for the CDC's latest, you know, web-based learning tool, because I think web-based learning is going to have to be an important component as we go forward with so many folks that we need to reach. And just that I also put in a plug for a coordinated curriculum between nursing, medical, and pharmacy schools. I went to medical school in Virginia at the Medical College of Virginia, and they actually, in the 70s, and they actually had a coordinated components of their curriculum even back then between nursing, medicine, and pharmacy, and I think it was a very helpful way to bring folks together who all especially have a role in immunization. And then in terms of assessment, again, most folks have talked about it. I mean, we really rely on our BRFSS data now to provide a lot of information about adult immunizations in Massachusetts, and that would really need to expand, as I think would all of the national surveys, because right now most adults, providers and adults are not being, you know, enrolled in registries, and their immunization information is not being entered into registries. And also that we would really need to think about this immunization site visit, this adult AFIX visit, and I haven't really had a chance to think a whole lot about it, but it's going to have to be a lot simpler, and we're going to need to have everything automated and done on laptops, and I know that COCASA has moved in that direction, and we're going to have to have some very simple, streamlined, I think, you know, quality assurance messages that can be adapted to these non-medical sites. And then I was asked to talk about requirements for adult immunization. And I have a little bit of a mixed feeling about this. The older I get, actually, and the longer I am in my public health career, I think we need to judiciously use requirements. And they are extremely important tool that we have in public health. But I really embrace the AIM philosophy about the principles when they should be used. So I'm more optimistic that we could employ them in the adult arena if we have resources for vaccination, because when you have vaccine, it's much easier to talk about requirements. But I think, again, we need unified national recommendations and endorsement of them by all of the bodies, which is essential. And over recent years, I think that has occurred more, certainly for a long time now with the unified schedule for children and adolescents, but more now for adult guidelines, and that national standards and regulations are much more effective than state by state. And I think that this is where a difference for children, where really the legal authority to require vaccinations for schools lie within the states for the rule and regulation making process. But for adults, I think there's a lot of federal bodies that cross state borders and would be a much more efficient way to do it than on a state-by-state basis. And if we are going to have to create requirements at the state level to really focus on the groups that are most important, like healthcare workers, childcare workers, and public safety and essential infrastructure personnel. And then finally, this is my final slide, and it looks like I'm finishing a little early here. Really, I think it takes a village to vaccinate adults. In Massachusetts, again, we're very fortunate to have healthcare reform, and so I think that will help us to expand access to healthcare for adults, just like we have for children, and empower and encourage vaccination in the medical homes. And I think we really need to support adult providers. They are struggling very hard right now to figure out how to incorporate vaccinations into adult primary care, and be supportive of vaccination outside the medical home, and not see that as competition, but rather as help other folks helping to support to take care of our patients. Use traditional and non-traditional vaccinators, and again, not feel threatened, because when we have so many million people now that we need to vaccinate, we are going to need every able-bodied person and arm to do that. And then the use of immunization registries, which is important in children, but I we've been able to be successful in Massachusetts with lots of fluctuation in the success of our registry. But I think for adults, it's really going to be vital. So that's the end of my talk, and I guess now we'll open it to questions. Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank all of our speakers, and we do have a few minutes for some questions. So, Ray, go ahead and lead off.
Thank you. An excellent panel, and I appreciated the comments very much. This is Ray Strickas, National Vaccine Program Office. I have, two comments and one question. Your input and that of others that Gina is aware of will help the National Vaccine Advisory Committee, which is forming an adult immunization working group, think about these issues about expanding access and how to improve coverage levels. I think curriculum is very important. Some years ago, when I was at CDC, we looked at curriculum issues for medical schools and residency programs and found variable degrees of teaching. What we didn't do, and I think in pursuing curriculum, one needs to try to make sure immunization questions get on the tests that certify people. Because if it's not on the test, it doesn't matter. So as we think about curriculum and education, continuing medical education, which is very valuable, unfortunately, you've got to get it on the test. My question is, and I think Susan alluded to this, so maybe it's more for Dr. Bailowitz, I'm not aware of any state regulation for nursing homes or hospitals that's been assessed to see if it actually makes a difference in the number of healthcare workers or patients that get vaccinated. This is adult patients. We tried to look at this for nursing home regulations some years ago and couldn't find that there was any benefit. When we thought in most cases it was too early, too little time had passed since the law was passed to require that nursing home residents be offered vaccine and see if more of them were vaccinated or more of the healthcare workers in those nursing homes were vaccinated. I know some states have laws to require that hospital patients be offered vaccine, but I'm not aware of any data that actually demonstrates those laws make a difference. I expect they could make a difference, but I'm concerned that maybe there aren't the resources to assess compliance because it's a challenge to see if they're compliant. So if you could comment on whether you know of data, your own or others, that the regulations at the state level actually make any difference.
Great. This is Ann. I'm honestly not aware of any data. A researcher that comes to mind is Christy Nichols, who's done a lot of work on flu and pneumonia. I honestly don't know if Michigan, which is where she is currently located, has a law or not, but that might be a source. I have not done a review of the literature on that, but certainly is an appropriate question. It might be a little bit early to do a full assessment given the recent legislation.
I'm not aware of any data, and we're just in our first year in Massachusetts of having a requirement for healthcare workers in long-term care facilities. So, and we don't have any requirement about offering it to residents. So, I don't know if LJ or Gina are aware of anything.
Hi, thank you for your presentations. I had two questions. One specifically for Anne. When we were going over the decision in 05 about the requirement for hepatitis B, it seems like the state kind of sprung that on you all, and I was wondering if the schools and the health departments had any input in that decision, or was it indeed a surprise? And then second, Susan mentioned something about insurers paying for vaccinations outside of the medical home, and I was wondering if there were any examples from an association perspective with LJ, a local perspective with Ann, and a state perspective with Susan, about what are some of the actions that you all are taking to actually break down those barriers?
JR, with reference to the first question, we, you know, obviously as a city health department follow the legislation. I don't know particularly the history of that, but it certainly was reviewed and input was made on it. I can say that the person that introduced it is a nurse, and I really don't think it was a bad idea. Coming to it as a pediatrician, I would say that I would prefer that kids entering school are up to date for all immunizations, and that means just automatically adding on the ones as they come up, i.e., you know, MCV4, TDAP, et cetera, because one of the negative effects of legislation is that it's often too little too late, and you wind up entrenching rather, old standards of what it means to be current. You know, we've gone far beyond Hep B and varicella, and yet, that's where things are in terms of, these shots, you need to be compliant. So I would say, really, they should be up to date for everything, and it should apply to, it should be age appropriate depending on what grade the child is going into. But, long story short, we saw it coming a little bit before it hit, and we were energetic in meeting it, and the State Health Department was extremely helpful. They had already prepared an excellent binder with background information, set letters for administrators, and templates that one might use for parents, et cetera. So we were, we had some preparation.
I can talk a little bit about, I think we all know that this, this barrier exists in both adult and childhood vaccinations, that most health plans will only pay for vaccination in the medical home. And this is going to be a big barrier to rolling out adolescent immunizations. I mean, it's been less of a barrier right now for younger age groups, but when we met with our health plans in January, or sort of in February, actually right after the ACIP meeting, and talked about the fact that we were going to maybe want to be thinking about expanding access for adolescents in many venues, there was a lot of resistance to that. In adults, we've been facing this problem for a number of years, and after a large amount of effort, we now have about a half a dozen senior plans in Massachusetts which allow folks to get vaccinated outside of their medical home, and we have arrangements with them about how local health departments and community vaccinators can build, but it's only a handful of plans, and it's taken a lot, many years. So I think that this is basically a national problem that every state sort of works at on its own. But we're assuming that we will, use our pediatric council, which is a forum that we have where, this is for adolescents, where we use our pediatric council as a forum where we will try to really encourage all the health plans to allow children and adolescents now to get vaccinated outside the medical home, and use our adult coalition to help continue to expand access for adults. But I heard even yesterday in the HPV session that women of childbearing age are trying to get HPV vaccine, say at their GYN appointments, and that's not considered the medical home by their health plan, and they're having to pay out of pocket, or their copay is increased. So I think this is a big barrier across the board in adult immunization.
Thanks, JR, for that question. I think on the national level, I think you've touched on the huge deficit of any kind of financing or funding for adult vaccination in the United States. And I think it's hard to even say, how do you talk about having insurance coverage outside the medical home when, we're actually not doing so well inside in the medical home with regards to adult vaccination. So I think it's a multiple prong attack. I think what you can look at is, first, you want to increase, traditional primary care to continue to provide adult vaccines and ensure that there's coverage there. And then I think you then start working with employers who define a lot of the insurance plans that they offer to the employees, and make sure the employers and their benefits consultants recognize the fact that there is a benefit to immunizations, especially for their employees, and have them work with their health plans to expand coverage outside the medical home. And then you need to work with the insurers to show that there is a obviously return of investment if they're going to go ahead and agree to do this. And then I think at that point, then you need to start talking about what is adequate payment, because I think then that's going to come up. What's the actual cost for a provision of an adult vaccine inside versus outside the medical home? And I think all those things we're only touching the surface of discussing all of that. Is I think you were at the National Immunization Congress that we held last year, and there's some task force that are now formed out, and they've been working on discussing these issues. And I can tell you, just monitoring the conversations with these task forces, that we're just scratching the surface, because there are a lot of complex issues that are going to be dug up as you go into this. You know, for example, the class, you know, you can say, let's say you convince the insurers to cover in vaccines outside the medical home. How do you then say that what that payment should be? Because as we know, it's a little bit more cost effective to provide adult vaccines outside the medical home in complementary settings. So what if an insurer says, well, why don't we just vaccinate outside the medical home? You have to think about all the ramifications of that process. And I think that's something that we're only beginning to scratch the surface on.